thank you so much for allowing me to facilitate a time of thought for us, this intellectual meal. Nice, Ange. Those are some blankets. Slight disclaimer before I begin everything. This coming week is my last week of school, so I have a lot of finals. As an English major, I actually don't have any written finals. It's all writing, though, you know, so it's all papers and stuff, one getting upwards of 40-plus pages, and so my mind is kind of in the writing mode, which just means that all the sentences I say are running through my head, like, is this precise? Is this exactly what I want to say? So I find myself during writing season to stumble on my words a lot more and to have to retrace certain clauses and whatnot. So please bear with me in regards to that. But yeah, it's so great to be here. I would like to start off our evening's intellectual meal with a little exercise in amateur sociology by considering a certain sort of person, which I think is found in every area of our social experiences. Knowing very little of the field, I will begin our exercise with some rough and ready descriptions of this sort of person in hopes that images will emerge in your mind of the sort of person I'm talking about. These people are generally described as ones who take names and labels very seriously. Let's consider them. In academics, it's the sort of person who's barely part of the AP honors crowd, maybe taking like one or two classes, generally scoring between like two or threes on those AP tests, but cares about being in the honors crowd more than anyone. They're the people who probably won't get into the highest ranked colleges, but are incessantly talking about college, always asking you about your college apps, your SAT scores. What are you gonna put in your personal statement? What does your resume look like? The one who's always trying to name drop philosophers, use big words that don't exactly sound idiomatic when they use them in the context of their sentences. Like when I try to make the noun form of suffering, suffrage, in English class. I mean, considering this past election, suffrage and suffering, I don't know. But in sports, the one who's generally on the bench, but is always seen wearing that uniform and that sports team apparel at school, repping the sport more than anyone who even plays it. The one who owns an expensive pair of Jordans but can't make a layup. The one who only wears surf tees but can't surf. In ASB, the one who runs for class president year after year, invests unusual amounts of time and energy into their campaigns, but is known at school not as someone who would make a good president, but as someone who really wants that position. Also an ASB, the person who always reminds you that they're an ASB, and they have an insider's perspective on every school function. Or in arts, I think we all have one here, the choir girl, who's always singing really loud in the music building even after practice ends, and sometimes around campus, and she might even have a pretty good voice, and you would perhaps even enjoy her singing if you didn't hear it so much. The drama guy who's totally embraced the drama kid image and doesn't even try to act normal anymore. Those girls or guys, actually, in dance crew who are always practicing the routines in public, even though everyone knows they know them cold. They're really just doing it to be seen. As lovers, they're the sort who don't try any of the activities above because they're in love. And their world shrinks to a conglomeration of date nights, anniversaries, codependence, breakups, and eventual broken hearts. They are the couples who win the prize for the most unnecessarily public displays of affection. They might as well wear t-shirts saying, "I'm in a relationship, look at me." They're the ones who are always somehow trying to bring in Bae into the conversation when she's not even a part of it. And friends, they're the ones who are way more into the friendship than you are. And they're more intent on being friends with you than they are intent on knowing you. Always trying to reaffirm their friendship with you through Facebook birthday posts, snap streaks, gifts. The ones who use variations of "hey bro" and do you even lift, but are really just like as skinny as me? We generally call these people try hard or wannabes. We feel bad for them because they're the sort of person who is always trying to be a sort of person. Whether it be an athlete, high achiever, chick magnet. But these people are generally balanced out by those who run under the banner of just be yourself. There was the vibe of the hipsters before they became mainstream. And what does just be yourself really mean? As one writer put it, how can we be ourselves if we don't know who we are? Being yourself assumes that you have a known identity, that you know who you are. And I find that a rather questionable assumption. Now, as much fun as it is to talk about those tryhards, those wannabes out there that we all know, see around school, perhaps our friends, if we had a little honesty hour right here, wouldn't we have to conclude that we are all, to some degree, tryhards, wannabes? I mean, in a literal sense, we're all trying hard at something, right? We're all wanting to be someone. We might fit in enough to escape the people labeling us as tryhards or wannabes. But I'm convinced that every single person here is trying hard at something, wanting to be someone, no matter what people say. Perhaps what's more concerning than being a tryhard is being someone who doesn't try hard at anything. Perhaps what's more concerning about being a wannabe is someone who doesn't want to be anything. And so the search begins. From our birth to some 80 years old, if we're lucky, we're striving, searching, working to find who we are. And isn't that the case when we take a step back? The unexamined life is not worth living. So I thank you. I thank you for coming here on this unrepeatable Saturday night to take a step back, to pause and see what are we actually doing, to take a step back out of our schedules filled with trying hard at something, trying to be someone, to stop, take a meta stance for a little bit. Some of us might become self-satisfied, rich entrepreneurs of tech startups. Some of us here might become the next Jeremy Lin, maybe. The next Michael Phelps. I bet a lot of you are in a swim, huh? Some of us here, someone here might marry the best looking person in the whole San Gabriel Valley. But it might also be true that most of us here will become engineers, doctors, computer scientists, drinking boba on the weekends with STEM degrees from one of four UCs. Either way, though, really, does this... You all right? Either way, though, does this striving for identity end when you, say, reach college? Well, I'll stand as a living witness to the fact that being a college student does not mean you stop striving for identity. People in college are striving for identity just as much as anyone. Does it end when you become rich? Oh, just read the headlines. Rich celebrity after rich celebrity spending tons of money trying to fill their empty, diamond-studded voids. The fact is, being a doctor, being a computer scientist, being an engineer, these are functional identities we could take into the circus of society, but when we come home, we take off that name badge, when we take off that coat, those scrubs, it's all quiet uptown, and the day is ending, and the dust of the day starts settling in our minds, the questions remain, don't they? Who are we? What are we doing in the world? Don't we all, to some degree, try to present ourselves to the world as put together, independent, unique, you know? with the funniest, most enviable snap stories with the best captions to our Instagram posts. Like we post a picture of ourselves. Oh, thank you, whoever, for making the best and sweetest prom proposal ever. Same old cardboard from Rite Aid. Probably recycled from a science project in junior high. Same old cheap flowers from Ralph's. Or worse yet, picked from around the campus. I've actually been a witness to that. That's pretty unfortunate. I don't think that's going to be the best one ever. Or how about this? You post a picture of yourself looking all hashtag chillax. Hashtag, oh, just cool vibes. And then you anxiously check your phone, all insecure about whether or not it's going to get enough likes. I mean, at that point, I think we're just actors on a stage. That's maybe the identity we put out during the day. But if you're like me, then in the quiet hours, you're singing a different tune. In the quiet hours, you're confiding in people more like Jay Gatsby from Fitzgerald's novel, you know? The orgiastic, riotous party is over. The guests have left. The servants are cleaning up the mess of the extravaganza, pulling up champagne glasses from swimming pools, sweeping together glitter that once covered the dresses of glamorous women now gone. And Jay Gatsby, that old sport, Jay Gatsby walking down the steps of his mansion, surveying the whole ordeal with eyes seeing but unsatisfied. Don't we all, at the end of a long, riotous day full of assignments and laughing with friends, each walk out to the end of our own piers, stretched out over a black and brooding sea betwixt metropolis and metropolis, between one full day and the next? And then we reach out to that green light, ever glowing, but always out of reach. Don't we all, at some time, resonate with that universalized voice of that deep philosopher, Taylor Swift, as she bemoans lost love and searches for that elusive childhood innocence we all remember and always outgrow? Am I the only one who, walking above a mass of LA County city lights, stops in that higher silence between electric lamps and those heavenly sentinels, our ancient stars, and concludes, what I think I found the sweetest pleasure is when I find it's just a measurement of longing, of clawing, of sprinting up a wall and falling to the ground, that canvas my blood has painted on, that canvas my tears will dampen till they're gone, my blood and tears. I've soaked in reasons to believe. I've jumped through hoops of valid thought, but past the facts and disciplines I act for where my heart is at. I will collapse behind these earthly walls. I will live in desperation. I will never be at ease inside this world of imperfectionists. I will cry, and I will whisper, and kiss, and hug, and dance. But I will never sigh contented as if I've reached you in advance of death. Oh, make me a faithful dreamer, steady in his restlessness. I won't let go of longing to find I've grabbed at less. Oh, let my longings kill me before I drown them in distraction. Let my longings kill me before I find them in a lifeless form and floating down chaotic streams that never seem to run. The crazy thing is this, that these longings for more than this world has to offer is not just a symptom. It doesn't just plague the underprivileged. It plagues especially the privileged, especially those who are high achievers. It was only last semester, in the first part of November, that I sat down to work on a literature paper like any other evening and got the text that my friend, one of my closest friends in high school, had died, had committed suicide. Valedictorian of my class, excellent soccer player, popular, got a full ride to Pepperdine where he studied philosophy and mathematics. The sort of person that you have to have he has to have his own category in your mind to understand him. He was just that good at everything. I remember freshman year, one of my friends telling me, I think I need to be more like Devin.
He was that sort of guy. It wasn't long after his death that I found out about a blog he kept. In the beginning words of a poem he posted on the front of his blog page haunt me. It says, "I was a Christian school prodigy. My parents had high hopes for me, but they all didn't see the little bit of sadness inside me. Except less like a little and more like a lot. And less like sadness and more like madness. And less like madness and more like hyper-sameness." He goes on to say that alcohol gives his meaning life. That poem was a cry from a Hannah Baker to the world. It's a weird thing to attend a friend's funeral. To see mutual friends walk a casket up the aisle to a hearse. And you think to yourself, what does all this morbid paraphernalia have to do with my friend? Why are there dates and epitaphs next to his name? And why did he lose hope? Why did he lose hope in this life? As said in one film, hope is a good thing. It may be the best of things. You know, G.K. Chesterton says that meaninglessness does not come from weariness of pain, but from weariness of pleasure. In a way, our whole lives can be defined as a tension between hope and despair, a cycle of expectation and disappointment. How are we going to handle this, the hopes and disappointments in our life? C.S. Lewis describes two kinds of ways people generally deal with hope and disappointment. The first one, he says, is the fool's way. Now, the fool's way is the strategy of the person who puts hope for fulfillment of his deepest desires in things themselves. And when they disappoint him, he goes on to the next thing, trying to find fulfillment in that, assuming that there is a thing out there that fulfills him, and he could just go along and find it. Now, he's the sort of person who's thinking, oh, if only I had a better job, if only a prettier girlfriend, if only that promotion, if only that college acceptance letter. He's always disappointed, always moving from one thing to another, his heart restless. And then there's a second way. Lewis says it's the way of the disillusioned, sensible man. Now, the disillusioned, sensible man, he started out like the fool. Hoped that certain things would fulfill him. And you know what? He realized, yeah, they don't. And so he concludes that there is no fulfillment to our desires. That it's all sentimentalism. He's the guy who says, oh, you know, I was like you when I was younger. But I've grown since then. I realize that all what you're doing is a chasing after the wind, just a search for the rainbow's end. He says, all your idealism, just a product of adolescence, all moonshine. Yeah, he's a pretty grumpy dude. And he doesn't find too much fulfillment either. Now, you might have met people like this. You yourselves might already identify with one of these two people. And if those were the only two ways we could deal with hope and disappointment in this world, good grief, this is going to be a bleak 80 years. But C.S. Lewis, he describes a third way that you could deal with hope and disappointment. And this way, he says that maybe everything in this universe, everything in the world, was not meant to fulfill our deepest desires. We're not meant to fulfill them, but to arouse them and point us to where the fulfillment really lies. The bottom line is this. Charity and half and half are not going to quench your deepest thirst, no matter how big of a cup you upgrade that drink to. No matter how many free drinks you have on your stamp cards right now, it's just not going to satisfy your deepest thirst. And neither will alcohol or GPAs or pretty girls and strong guys. Neither acceptance letters to Harvard. Oh, nothing is going to satisfy the deepest desires in our hearts. So what? Maybe C.S. Lewis is right. if we find in ourselves desires which nothing in this world could satisfy. The most logical explanation is that we were made for another world. If you're hungry, that's because there exists food. If you're frisky, that's because there exists sex. If you're curious, that's because there exists knowledge. If we are longing for something that is deeper and bigger than this world, that's because there is something bigger and deeper than this world. When we read the headlines and we long for a justice we have never seen perfectly enacted, but we still long for it, that's because there is a justice out there, a true lawyer who legislates over this world and rules the rulers of this world, including Donald Trump.
Put that out there. If we long for identity, that's because we have one. We have an identity. We are real people. We are real people. We have identities. We long for them. Again, everyone just turn to the person on your right and say, we are real people. Give it that earnest look, too. We are real people. Put your hands like this, please. Put it to your eye. Go look to the person on your left and say, we are real peoples. Just tell them that. We are real peoples. Thank you. I wanted to see that. All right. Now, I got a little intellectual taco for y'all. Personal identities could only be given or conferred. Just think about it. We find this out in our life. My dog Joy, she was just a golden retriever, just a female dog. Then she became Joy. Joy Shia, a member of our family. You gave her an identity. Dog to Joy. And you know, Disney and Pixar do this all the time. It was just a lion cub, and now it's Simba. Just a clownfish, now it's Nemo. Just a little red lizard, but now Mushu the dragon. See, it happens. You are just Homo sapiens, just rational animals. But now you're people, humans. How did that happen? You have an identity, said Anthony. Yo, you were a rational animal, but now you're Anthony. Yeah. I want you to learn something tonight, so. Yeah. So, if personal identity comes from someone higher, then it makes sense that we could confer personal identities to inanimate objects and animals and stuff, because we're higher beings, and therefore we can confer identity on them. And when you really think about it, the identities we confer to animals and inanimate objects are generally just human personality traits projected onto the things, right? And so, listen to this logic. Who gives human beings personal identity then? It must come from someone higher. If our bodies are part of nature, including our brains, just molecules put together, then fellow nature cannot give personal identity to fellow nature. We try to get that from our friends. We try to find our identity from fellow human beings. It doesn't work out so hot, does it? If a natural being has a personal identity, us natural beings, then it must come from a supernatural or above nature being. And in that way, it would make sense that we bear marks and longings and expectations for something outside this world, something even higher. You know my dog Joy over here? She's always trying to act like a human. It's really strange. She walks out. Huh, Joy? You walk out that door. You would rather sit at the table with us when we eat rather than go to the dog dish where you belong. And, maybe we're trying to act like something higher. Maybe we're trying to act
like the person who conferred identity to us. And maybe that's why we are so fascinated with things like the Avengers, you know, Iron Man, Captain America, you know? Maybe they're just modern symbols of the ancient demiurge.
Of course, you can't reject this as mere mythology, mere religious jargon. But let's do some thinking.
Let's look at the logical consequences of that. The 1800s and 1900s, full of famous examples of people who rejected that. Friedrich Nietzsche. Always pronounce it Nietzsche, not Nietzsche. That sounds like scratching a chalkboard with overgrown nails or something. Friedrich Nietzsche. He tried to get beyond good and evil. Dude, he went insane. He died a very sick man. Marx and Engels, they rewrote history as historical materialists. They left out the supernatural from their equation altogether. And their writings, yeah, inspired the bloodiest century in all human history. More people were killed in the 20th century than in the past 19 combined. Hitler, he believed that humans were just mere creatures, part of nature. And he followed his philosophy, destroyed 6 million of these creatures with gruesome experiments, abuse, labor, bug spray. That's what they found out, the gas was in those gas chambers like Auschwitz. Bug spray and gas chambers. Okay. Whoa. Okay, you might be saying that not everyone who rejects supernatural dignity conferred on human beings is going to end up killing them. And you're right. That doesn't necessarily mean that anyone's going to murder anyone. But the important thing is this, that without any supernatural conferring of dignity or identity to human beings, there is no philosophical grounds, no existential basis for why you shouldn't stratify people and eventually kill off the weaker ones. At the end of the day, in that framework, we're just more sophisticated animals, and the fittest of them survive. And in that framework, then all gay rights movements, all racial equality, that's all just minorities, weaker minorities trying to gain power to survive. I hope that angers you. But most of us are probably not really asking these questions. We reason that we don't have all the philosophical, we don't need all the philosophical bases so long as we're always believing that society progresses. Don't you love that word? Progresses. As science progresses, we say, there will be a cure for all diseases. We will live longer. We will be at peace with other people. But is that really how progress works? You see, progress doesn't mean anything until you ask the question, progressing towards what? What are the ideals to which we are moving? What are they? When we think of progress in science, such as CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing or the next generation of iPhones, we think of more control over nature, more precision, accuracy, efficiency, ease of use. But do you really see what that sort of progress is? The ability to own smaller and more efficient guns to carry out school shootings, a result of progress. The ability to load pornography on your phones and reduce human beings to mere objects, that's a result of progress. Nuclear weapons, it's a result of progress. Progress in science never meant moral or existential progress.
The two are quite different. Dr. John Lennox gives us the scope of what science and scientific progress kind of means. He says that, imagine a pot of water is put on a stove. It heats up and begins to boil. Then two people are asked, what is going on here?
First person puts on a pair of spectacles and says, the combustion of the gas is releasing a lot of energy into the liquid, causing vaporization, which results in the bubbles and the steam which you're seeing. Second person, I think someone's making a cup of tea.
Both answers are really, when you think about it, equally valid. One's just describing the efficient cause, and the other, the final cause. In other words, one's just describing how the physical process is going on, the other one is describing the intention, or why the physical process is being enacted. And that's the way science is. It tells us how the universe works, but it can never tell us the purpose or meaning of the universe. It can tell you how to keep your heart beating, but it cannot tell you why you should keep your heart beating. Its scope is limited to the natural world, and therefore it makes no sense to me when scientists say, I've searched the entirety of nature and found nothing supernatural, that is, outside of nature. Therefore, the supernatural doesn't exist. That doesn't make any sense to me. It's like saying, I studied a ship's engine for years and haven't found any sailor inside. Therefore, sailors don't exist, nor charted courses, nor voyages. Strange. Science, therefore, can tell us what our personal identities are. It cannot tell us what our personal identities are. It doesn't have power over that. It can define what our bodies are made out of, but it cannot tell us what we are as human beings, what humanness means. But, you know, I don't really think we have to get that philosophical to really figure that out. Do you really think technology is helping you figure out your identity today? That social media really stabilizes my search for who I am? Or is it more, it's what the poet says, whisper, whisper, circle of legs around it, the focal point of all eyes present, crying girl, looking down, all her friends are looking down, it lies there, dying on the ground. Friendship sink to 10%, the mind becomes a helpless babe without the master that it's made by using in relentless ways the one who's died there on the ground. Unprecedented access gives birth to newfound ignorance that wrecks the lives of intellects when forced to power down. The girl looks close and sees the truth. No longer Z or even youth. She looks around with naked eye and looks so naked standing by without the lies she hid behind. She bends down for one last glance, for one last chance to see her face reflected in the pixelated, blackest screen of other selves now cracked. In other words, I don't really think technology is helping us answer the identity question. Sorry for the drama. But before wrapping up this talk with a final point, I want to do a quick summary. So, all true longings have proper fulfillments. If you're hungry, there exists food. If we're longing for something bigger and deeper than the world, that's because there is something bigger and deeper than the world. If we're longing for identity, that's because we have identity. Two, personal identities can only be given or conferred. They're never just spontaneously generated by nature. We as human beings can know what that's like. Someone had to do that to us if we are to have actual, legitimate, operable personal identity. And so thirdly, our lives can thus be defined as either moving closer towards that objective identity, moving closer towards the person who confers or gives that identity, or moving away in diminishing turn in a perversion of that identity. and of that person. And so all this talk really boils down to this. If we have been given or conferred identities, then we will discover what they are and what they mean, not by looking inwards, but by looking to the one who conferred or gave that identity. If you want to know what a chair means or does, go and ask the carpenter. Go and ask the builder. If you want to know what the painting means, what's intended behind it, go and ask the painter. If you want to know your identity, we have to go and ask the identity giver. So you might be thinking, so you're trying to tell me now that this higher person conferring identities is a literal person who I could talk to, who I could ask questions about my identity to? Like, can't it just be a higher force? Can't it just be a more powerful entity in the skies? Remember your Descartes, people. For those of you who are not Descartes, everything in the effect must be in the cause. If we are personal, communicating, relational beings, that is because the cause is personal, communicative, relational. It's the only way it works. So here's a series of questions. What if we've got it wrong this whole time? What if the higher person is not just a projection of our imaginations and our psyche into the skies, as Sigmund Freud would have us believe, but the reverse? That we are a projection of the higher person's imagination, the higher person's psyche. What if the sun does not revolve around us, but we revolve around the sun? What if we stop trying to make sense of life by our own reasoning and philosophies and try to make sense of life by the higher person's reasoning and philosophies? Lewis said, "I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen. Not only do I see it, but by it, I see everything else." Perhaps life is not a giant, cold, bleak, white page which we have to write a little story on. Perhaps life is actually, our lives are actually part of a grander narrative being written by a divine author, and we were chosen, designed to play a part, to contribute to this story. I'm an English major. I love stories. I love this example. I love this image, so we're going to carry on with it. So, the story that we're in, one could easily object and say, okay, if we are living in a story, then we have no chance, no higher chance of knowing this author guy than Harry Potter has of knowing, say, J.K. Rowling. How could Harry Potter know the author? And you know what? I have to concede that point. That's true. We can't know the author as Harry Potter cannot know J.K. Rowling. Unless, of course, unless J.K. Rowling wrote herself as a character into her story. And that way they can interact. Same way we can't know any author of our lives, any divine giver of identities, unless, of course, he wrote himself in. He wrote himself into the human narrative, into the history of the universe. And friends, I'm here to tell you that that's the case. That is the case. He has, the great author, has left his culture and his society to come down into our narrative. He condescended and walked this earth. He knit himself
into humankind's genealogy. He drank our water. He ate our bread.
He became one of us. Might it be that Santa Claus, coming from the sky amid Yuletide cheer, bearing a slew of gifts, is really
just a tinny echo of what actually happened? The Creator, the divine gift giver, coming down to this earth?
But you could imagine, if a writer, if an author of a story actually did come down into his own story and claimed,
I am the author, you know, I have literally the authorship, the authority around here, and then just started doing wonders and, you know, challenging the people in power at the time and saying, well, actually, I'm the author. Wouldn't you suspect that something awful is going to happen? That's exactly what happened.
And if you know your history, you'll recognize it at this point. His own Jewish community did not recognize him. Despite his power, his otherworldly message, they convinced the Romans to help them nail him to a tree. And before he died, he said, "It is finished," as if he came here to do something, to accomplish a task, as if he were on a mission. He died, was buried, and all who rejected him and others who did believe in him thought that that was the end of that. But then 3 days later, he literally came back to life, and since then, humanity has been divided, has been a divided race of people who believe that. And people who haven't. Just think about it. I believe the entrance, death, the resurrection of the author has been the defining moment of all our history. BC turned to AD. Rome, the empire, was turned inside out. Even America was founded in connection with all this. And today, thousands of years later, people are still meeting together like we are now, to discuss questions concerning this. Did this really happen? Did he really come back to life? Is there true, deep forgiveness for my wrongs? If he's alive right now, can I meet this author? Do I actually have worth and identity? Friends, doesn't your whole being cry out for this narrative to be true? Cry out that we are not just the products of blind, pitiless chance, and as Dawkins says, just dancing to our DNA. That we are not just grown-up germs that can be sprayed with poison and killed in Nazi gas chambers. We feel that's wrong. Why? Maybe because it is wrong. Cry out that you and I don't need to strive, work all our lives to perhaps create an identity for ourselves, because we have a maker who has given us an identity already. In this way, we are free now, working not for identity, not working for worth, but working from the fact of our identity, working from the fact of our worth. We can become humans again, y'all, if we surrender our lives, our wills, to the maker of humans. He promises that we will be more than just humans, that we'll become part of the family, partake in his higher love and community. Oh yeah, he knows we messed up bad. He offers us forgiveness. His arms are open now. He has come into our narrative. He has made the way for us to know him. He gives us worth and identity. The light of his reasoning explains reality. And he resurrects human life from a dead, fatalistic sequence of physical processes to a real life, brimming hope, meaning in both pleasure and pain, with color and thickness, peril and venture, of romance in union. When we give up our aimless, roaming eyes for His, everything comes into focus, and for the first time, we really see the world, ourselves, others, with wonder, clarity, and love. When we give our lives to Him, we find them for the first time. I hope this is more than just food for thought for all of you. I hope it becomes for you living bread and living water, which when you partake in it, nourishes you till you find yourself every day moving not towards a mere funeral, but moving towards resurrection. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks so much, Dan. I almost called him Lit because, not because he's a Lit major, but because he was the littlest of my children. So he was always little man, the littlest guy, but he's got a big heart and a big, big idea. What we're going to do right now is kind of, we don't have that much time, but we want to just to hear what you have to say and share with one another and sharpen each other and see what this sparks. So pretty much, I'm going to actually, for the sake of time, we're not going to go ahead and divide it the way we were creatively trying to do. We're just going to go ahead and let you guys get together in groups that you feel comfortable with, and just let's talk. And there's discussion leaders who know the house, are at my house like the back of their hands, so they know where the spaces are. There's a little space for about eight in the, now it's like my Maranatha tennis room over there. There's space for about 10, 12 right here. There's the dining table. There's the living room, which has got another space for 10 plus, 15. There's the main dining table, so you guys all know where that is. Just grab together. We have space for about 6 to 8 groups, any way you want to do it. And then there's this space in here that can fit a whole bunch. And so if you guys can get together, and just for about half an hour, just get started, discussion group leaders. So let's just get started. Have it open. It's an open forum, open time. What do you think? What do you think of what he said? What do you, any questions, any thoughts, any comments, any wonderings? Did that inspire something? Did you disagree with something? What do you think? And let's go ahead and get together that way. And then I'll come around with some dessert afterwards, in the middle somewhere there. But why don't we just go ahead and get that started right now? And I'm going to just go ahead and let the group leaders go ahead and see where the congregating gets started. And let's go ahead. And so if you are cold, then feel free to go ahead. And that might be the decision, whether you stay out here or you go inside. If you like being out here and the blankie's nice, then you guys can go and do this. So just go ahead and find a place. It could be inside, it could be outside. And then get in a circle, and then let's have at it.